From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Eric Westervelt. Good morning. With just over 2 weeks left until voting ends, the presidential race remains a toss-up. Mara Liasson brings us the latest. Plus, Israel vows to continue fighting Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran. Mexico says it has a new plan for an old problem, drug cartel violence. And writer-director Sean Baker on his new movie, Anora, and why he's drawn to outsider characters in his films.
You could say marginalized subcultures or communities. I like to see it as people who are chasing the American dream, but don't have easy access to it.
And there's also the puzzle. It's Sunday, October 20th. The news is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. Jamie Becker Finn is working on advancing the Kamala Harris and Tim Walz ticket to the White House this election season. Becker Finn serves in the State House of Representatives, and as a Leech Lake Band descendant, she's working hard to get out the Native vote. She recently joined me to talk about what she's been hearing on the campaign trail. Well, Jamie, it's been a while since we've had a chance to chat. I understand that you are working on getting out the Native vote. How's that going?
You know, I think good. The conversations I've had with folks, people are pretty fired up. I think, you know, having Tim Walz on the ticket and, you know, people being more familiar, obviously, with the ticket has made people excited. And I think, too, just knowing sort of the level that we're dealing with here, with how bad things could get under another, Trump administration, and, you know, some fears around that, and making sure that we're doing what's best for Native folks and all Minnesotans.
Jamie Becker Finn, you are a Leech Lake band member yourself, right? What are some of the things you've been hearing as you've talking to folks, not just in your home district, but here in the North as well?
Yeah. So, yes, I'm a Leech Lake descendant, grew up in Calf Lake. You know, I think the thing that when I'm talking to folks, sort of attention to small businesses and making sure that everybody has a fair shot at, a good future, whatever that looks like. I think, you know, talking to people who have benefited certainly from some of the DFL programs that have passed in Minnesota in the last couple of years, and realizing the impact that things like that can have on people, you know, accessing school, you know, with the North Star Promise program, or accessing, you know, food and through our schools and all those kinds of things. People are really starting to notice. And I think that really speaks to what's possible through public policy.
And I know, like further down the ticket, for the state house seats, the land back measures that kind of started picking up a little steam last session are likely going to come back again. What are some of the things you've been hearing about those items, you know, as the state legislature looks at them again next year?
Yeah, you know, those were some bills that got a lot of attention, but maybe weren't moving forward at the speed at which certainly there were some folks, wanting to make them into something that divides us. And I think what's important is to ground us in the reality of where Minnesota sits. And, especially up in the northern part of the state, you know, people may be familiar or know Native folks, but like really understanding the history and the sovereignty and how important it is that we acknowledge those things. And it doesn't, you know, we don't have to talk about it in a way that's completely divisive. And I think it's easy to scare people. And that is what some folks have done with some of those issues. But I think it also speaks to what happens when we have Native folks in government. And when you have those voices in those roles, it's a different conversation. And I think that's really important. You know, I know we have Mike Reyes running from the Calf Lake area, and I think making sure that we have those people in office is going to continue to be important.
Election season seems to be certainly picking up steam that you want to make sure Native voters especially, know about as they, make their decisions to head to their polls.
Yeah, I think the most important thing for people to remember is that their votes do matter. They absolutely matter. Every individual vote is important, and it is our right to make that voice heard. And we want to make sure that we're doing it in a way that is supportive of policies that are actually going to be respectful and helpful to our communities. And I think that I just hope people remember that and remember how important it is to vote in our state and national, you know, our federal elections as well.
The Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe will hold early voting events on October 21st and October 30th. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Aisha Roscoe is away. I'm Eric Westervelt. Good morning. Our war has not yet ended. That's what Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said following the killing of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar. For the Biden administration, it presents an opportunity to realize a ceasefire in Gaza, something Biden has been pushing for months. Let's bring in Daniel Kurtzer. He's former U.S. ambassador to Israel and Egypt. He's now a professor of Middle East policy at Princeton. Ambassador, thanks for joining us. Good morning. Mr. Ambassador, do we have you there?
Good morning.
Good morning. Sinwar's death is a big blow to Hamas. The White House is encouraging Israel once again to sort of take the win and move toward ending this war. Neither Hamas nor Israel seem interested in that. Is this a moment when the Biden administration, you think, can actually help deliver a ceasefire?
Such a moment, an inflection point, an opportunity, whatever you want to call it. Chip in Israel, Netanyahu, and whoever succeeds.
Having a bit of trouble.
It's going to be very hard for the administration.
Having a bit of trouble with your line, Ambassador, we're going to move on to NPR's Mara Liasson. We'll come back to you. And to politics now, with just over a couple weeks until Election Day, and NPR's Mara Liasson joins us. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning.
So I want to talk about closing arguments with this campaign wrapping up and people already voting. On the Republican side, Donald Trump and some pretty clear and authoritarian sounding promises, including talk of using the military on the, quote, enemy within.
That's right. Trump's authoritarian rhetoric isn't new. For years, he's praised authoritarian leaders like Vladimir Putin and Viktor Orban. He's called for the Constitution to be terminated. But his authoritarian rhetoric in these closing days of the campaign has gotten much darker, more violent. Recently, as you said he would use the military to go after his political opponents. He said one rough, tough day of policing would solve the crime problem. He said that Jews would be to blame if he loses. And of course, his repeated refusals to say he'd accept the results of an election that he loses or commit to a peaceful transfer of power. That's kind of the essence of authoritarianism.
Sure.
Rules don't apply to him. Heads I win, tails you cheated. But, you know, there are two theories about this. One is that he's just letting his id flag fly and or being undisciplined, as some Republicans believe. But other Republicans tell me they think there is a strategy behind this extreme rhetoric, that the more he can scare, anger, motivate the low propensity voters who favor him but are much less likely to turn out, the better it is for him.
Interesting. But I want to bring up something else about Trump as the campaign starts to wrap up. And last night in Latrobe, Pennsylvania was one of many examples. That's Arnold Palmer's hometown. Here's a bit of what Trump had to say.
Arnold Palmer was all man. And I say that in all due respect to women, and I love women. But this guy... This is a guy that was all man. This man was strong and tough. And I refuse to say it, but when he took showers with the other pros, they came out of there, they said, oh, my God. That's unbelievable. I had to say it.
I mean, Mara, that was just part of a 12-minute ramble on this dead golfer. What do you make of Trump's increasingly erratic behavior and talk?
I don't know what I make of it, but there sure is a lot of it. In addition to the fire hose of lies, he has been erratic. He goes off script for large chunks of his speeches. He mispronounces names. He seems to lose his train of thought. Lots of profanity. And of course, you just heard him referring to Arnold Palmer's Male Anatomy. The other day, he spent 39 minutes at a rally just playing music. He didn't talk at all. He just kind of bopped along on stage. And Politico reported that his campaign had told people he was exhausted, which now his campaign and he both deny. But he is 78 years old and he hasn't ever released his medical records.
Well, let's turn to Kamala Harris. She's got Barack Obama out campaigning for her, popular with Democrats. He's also, you know, making arguments to black men in particular to vote for her. She's also got Liz Cheney out there trying to woo Republicans. On Tuesday, there's an online book event with authors, including Joyce Carol Oates. I guess that's for the Barnes & Noble suburban crowd. I mean, does she have a closing argument, Mara, to speak of, or is it more a strategy of kind of flooding the zone?
Well, I think it's both. She's looking for voters' votes wherever she can, including the suburban woman book club vote, maybe. But her closing argument has put Donald Trump much more in the foreground than she has in the past. She says he's dangerous, unstable, lost, confused. You know, back in 2016, the Clinton campaign used to beg the media to stop covering Trump wall to wall. Stop covering his speeches live, they would say, in his press conferences. Now the Harris campaign wants more coverage of Trump. Now that the TV networks are no longer carrying his rallies live, the Harris campaign wants to draw attention to Trump's extreme rhetoric and erratic behavior. They want to remind voters what they used to not like about Trump. And so Harris has actually begun playing clips of Trump at her own rallies.
Interesting. And of course, Mara, this comes down to a handful of key swing states. Are you seeing any moves by the campaigns that tell you which ones are really up for grabs?
No, they're all up for grabs. Neither of these candidates have given up or taken for granted any of the seven battleground states. And this is a race that is really close. And we are a deeply divided, evenly divided country. And that makes our politics very unstable.
NPR's Mara Liasson, thank you.
Thank you.
A new president in Mexico faces the same challenge her predecessors did, how to curb rampant violence by drug cartels. The past couple of weeks have seen jarring violence in two state capitals. There were open shootouts in the city of Culiacan in the northwest and the gruesome murder of the mayor of Chilpancingo in the south. Earlier this month, President Claudia Sheinbaum, the first woman to ever lead the country, outlined her administration's security strategy. Carlos Bravo Regidor is a political analyst and columnist for El Heraldo de México, and he joins us from Mexico City. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Carlos, help us put this into perspective. Just how big are the challenges around security and cartel violence that this new administration faces?
Well, without doubt, security is the main challenge. In the case of Claudia Sheinbaum, she's trying to put together a strategy that has contrasts with what López Obrador did.
That's Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the former president.
Yes. Claudia Sheinbaum belongs to the same party. And in the case of security, it is, you know, pretty clear that López Obrador's strategy didn't work. She's going to try, within certain limits and restrictions, something different. But at the same time, she cannot call it a change because that would imply recognizing that the López Obrador administration failed.
Carlos, give us a clear example, perhaps, of a change in policy that you see coming from her administration.
One of the most important changes is the emphasis on intelligence in fighting organized crime. López Obrador's strategy was based on a certain sense of appeasement with criminal organizations, given the fact that frontal combat many times ends up producing more violence. And they wanted to avoid this. So they chose a sort of appeasement policy that, you know, in a way, worked in having homicides not grow, but remain with very high levels. But there was no really intelligence strategy to combat the organizations, not through sheer force, but also where it hurts them the most, which is their finances.
Okay, so she's bolstering intelligence, but you're telling me that the appeasement policy has not brought down the number of homicides. It's sort of just plateaued them.
There is a small reduction, to be fair. But the thing is that, you know, when you focus so much on homicides as the main indicator, we tend to miss a point, which is the following. sometimes homicides are just a reflex of the fact that criminal organizations are fighting amongst each other, you know, for the control of territories, for the control of markets. When homicides come down, it doesn't necessarily mean that the state has regained territorial control of security. It might as well mean that organizations have consolidated their control over a region or over a market to the point where homicides are no longer necessary. So, you know, it's very deceiving.
And Carlos, extortion around key industries and produce and farming continues as well, yes?
Yes, it's almost as if criminal organizations are starting to charge additional taxes to people, to companies. It means that criminal organizations are, in many regions, running the show.
President Sheinbaum has talked about expanding social programs to try to prevent young Mexicans from being recruited by organized criminal networks. Is there any evidence, Carlos, that these programs are working?
No, there isn't. Cash transfers in general have become like a one-size-fits-all solution. It was with López Obrador, and it seems that Claudia Sheinbaum is going to continue down that path. You know, whatever the amount that the state provides to support these young people to, you know, stay in school, don't join the ranks of crime, to put it in very, you know, blunt economic terms, it's not competitive in comparison with the money they can get if they join the gangs. It's sad, but it's just the hard, cold truth.
President Sheinbaum's predecessor, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is also her mentor, and he was wary of cooperating fully with the U.S. and going after the drug cartels. Do you expect her to continue that skeptical approach?
The thing is this. Mexico has ended up in a very toxic place in American politics. Fentanyl, particularly, the traffic of fentanyl to the U.S. has become a domestic problem. And the U.S. is clearly tired of Mexico's appeasement approach and has taken you a different path. This might be telling us that priorities, security-wise, between Mexico and the U.S. are not aligned. And if they are not aligned, it's very hard to assume that there will be any more cooperation. Quite to the contrary, I think this is a scenario where there is going to be conflict between both governments regarding what to do about violence and about drug trafficking.
Carlos Bravo Regidor is a political analyst and journalist in Mexico City. Carlos, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of every month. If you have questions or are interested in joining the board, contact us at 218-326-1234 during business hours. The board's full meeting schedule is available online at kaxe.org. During the Come Home to KXE Fall Membership Drive, KXE staff are holding trivia nights Thursday, October 24th in Bemidji and Grand Rapids. The 6 p.m. events are at Bemidji Brewing and Clockout Brewing in Grand Rapids. All are welcome. Adventures in Lifelong Learning meets every Tuesday morning at the Bemidji Eagles Club, now through November 12th. Refreshments served at 9:30 with various speakers at 10 a.m. each meeting. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition here on KAXE, KBXE.
I'm Duahli Saikautau in New York City with these headlines. Millions of people in Cuba are still without power. Many are using candles and lamps as that country's electricity company tries to restart thermoelectric power plants that failed 2 days ago. Russia says it intercepted more than 100 Ukrainian drones overnight. Its defense ministry said some of the drones targeted an explosive factory just east of Moscow, as well as the border region of Kursk. And President Biden says in a statement that he's heartbroken about news that part of a ferry dock collapsed on Georgia's Sapelo Island, killing at least seven people. I'm Duahli Saikautau, NPR News in New York.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrust.org/afterthefact. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Eric Westervelt. AI-generated images have been a thing this election season. Deep fakes haven't necessarily been fooling people, at least not for long. But experts watching online spaces say the images serve a different purpose, propaganda. NPR's Hu Jingnan has our story.
You might have seen this image circulating on social media already.
This AI-generated image of a very cute and very helpless-looking little girl holding a puppy in a canoe in the midst of what appears to be terrible flooding associated with the recent hurricanes.
That was Eddie Perez, a former Twitter employee who is now focusing on confidence in elections at the nonpartisan nonprofit OSET Institute. While the image got millions of views on X, formerly Twitter, many users were quick to point out that it carries telltale signs of generative AI. But that didn't matter for some prominent people who shared it, like Amy Kramer, who is a Republican National Committee member representing Georgia. She wrote that she, quote, doesn't care where the image came from. It's, quote, emblematic of real suffering.
As a form of political communication, you can use an image to convey a broader truth.
Renee DiResta is a researcher at Georgetown University who recently published a book about online influencers. She says that the so-called deeper truth can be divorced from facts.
It's a form of political propaganda, a way to signal interest and support for a candidate, almost like in a fandom kind of style.
Many Trump supporters expressed sympathy for the fictional girl, but it was also a way to criticize the Biden administration's hurricane relief efforts. A similar dynamic appeared after Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance boosted false claims about Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio. Trump fans posted AI-generated images of the former president cuddling cats and dogs while attacking Biden's immigration policies.
Political campaigns then can pick it up, can retweet it, can boost it, and are then seen as being sort of in on the conversation, maybe in on the joke themselves.
This kind of participation gives supporters camaraderie and entertainment. It's not a new dynamic, but AI tools make it easy and potentially lucrative.
On X, for example, you can monetize your account. And so if you produce a compelling image that a lot of people engage with, you actually can earn money from that.
These images often don't stand up to scrutiny, but can pass as a photo at first glance. Studies show that people are bad at telling fakes from real photos. Take a recent image that falsely suggested pop star Taylor Swift had endorsed Trump. There was a lot of blowback after Trump shared it, even though it didn't really look like her.
It wouldn't have been a scandal if someone had drawn Taylor Swift in a comic endorsing Trump.
Anna Mergen is an art history scholar at New York University. Swift has since endorsed Kamala Harris for president. In many ways, these AI-generated images aren't meant to pass as photos. They're more like political comics. Take this image.
A person who looked very much like Kamala Harris, wearing a kind of Soviet-style or Red China-style CCP, you know, communist-looking uniform.
That's Eddie Perez again. He says these kind of images are still harmful, not because they are deceptive, but because they inflame political polarization.
These images and the polarization is sending the message that there is no legitimate way that Kamala Harris and her party could actually win a presidential election.
And that could damage the public's confidence in the vote count. Hua Jingnan, NPR News.
Their names may not appear on court briefs or judicial decisions, but behind the scenes, incarcerated people have played a big role in the law for decades. A new initiative wants to introduce the world to these jailhouse lawyers. NPR's Kerry Johnson has our story.
When Jody Polk entered a Florida prison years ago, she noticed something special about the women in the law library.
And I remember when they walked in, they felt taller than the rest of us. It was the knowledge that they had, the way they used legal language, the confidence that they had.
Those women had no formal legal training, but they had prestige. They figured out how to decode the law to help other people in prison. Polk became one of them.
The first time I read a law book. It was like finding the cheat code to life.
All of a sudden, she says, she understood important things about housing, education, and constitutional rights. Now out of prison, Polk dedicates herself to sharing that wisdom. Her Jailhouse Lawyers Initiative counts 1,000 members across every U.S. state. This week, they're hosting a meeting in New York and launching a new website. It's filled with oral histories and hundreds of letters from people in prison who work with the law. Brandon Toole found the law when he was incarcerated in Texas.
I'd go in at like 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'd be in there sometimes until 8 o'clock at night. And I just fell in love with just reading the case law, learning the policies and the statutes.
Toole says prison can be dehumanizing. Authorities refer to you by a number, not your name. But those long hours in the library found him writing complaints and prison grievances, helping challenge convictions, and preparing parole applications for other people. Those moments gave him a boost, too.
Once I started helping other people, like on a big scale, like I just saw how it, it made my time a little bit better. It made me happier because I was doing something worthwhile. And then it just kind of snowballed from there.
Toole won parole last year. He now lives in Houston and works with families of people who are incarcerated.
Giving people tools and knowledge of the law is the right thing to do.
That's Tyler Walton. He's managing attorney at the Jailhouse Lawyers Initiative.
I think that the law should be working for everybody, and the way that we're going to move towards that is if everybody has a place to participate in the law.
The Supreme Court enshrined the role of jailhouse lawyers back in 1969 in a case about William Joe Johnson, also known as Joe Ritz. He was a Tennessee inmate who helped illiterate fellow prisoners file legal petitions. Prison officials threw Johnson in solitary for violating a rule that barred inmates from helping with legal matters. The justices ruled people in prison have a right to access the courts, but they did not require states to provide prisoners with attorneys. So jailhouse lawyers flourished inside prison walls, even if they remained invisible on the outside. Again, Jody Polk.
When a jailhouse lawyer works on a case, it's pro se. And so their name is typically never mentioned inside of the appellate brief or the outcome. And so there's so many cases where there is a jailhouse lawyer behind it. So many policy changes.
The vast majority of people who enter prison eventually return home. But jailhouse lawyers run into some big complications. They're not allowed to practice law once they leave prison, because that's strictly controlled by state and legal officials. Again, Tyler Walton.
And so suddenly what we see is that jailhouse lawyers who often have developed these legal skills over decades, helping their community, as soon as they get out, they can be at threat for prosecution if they do the same work that they were doing while they were on the inside.
He says there's a huge need for people outside prison who can translate what happens inside. Exactly what jailhouse lawyers have been doing for decades, to little acclaim. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
For kids, the world can be magical. It's a place of wonder, populated with superheroes and Barbie dolls, terraformed by video games and cartoons, and stocked with candy, especially this time of year. But how do the cultural objects we love as kids shape how we see the world as adults? A new NPR series explores this. It's called Throw It Back.
So my object is habesha kamis. It's a traditional Ethiopian dress that my mom made for me for my first birthday.
Throw It Back begins with Mahalet Assefa and the story of her cotton dress.
Girls across sort of all ages, women have habesha kamises that they wear to weddings, to christenings, graduations. We also wear it to church on Sundays. And my dress, you can sort of see gold thread catching the light. It's something that brings me back home, and I think it's beautiful.
Mahalet Assefa lives in Seattle with her family, but for her, home is Bahr Dar in northern Ethiopia. It's where she spent part of her childhood.
I grew up in that small city, and my two aunts, my mom's sisters, lived with us, and they helped take care of us. So my parents went to work, but when I came back from school or in the mornings, there was so much joy. The house was always full of people. I remember seeing pictures of me in the dress when I was really young. In these pictures, I saw myself sort of running around at this party with the green dress among red balloons, and our front yard had these two huge mango trees. We'd sit on the veranda and everybody would get their own mangoes, and every adult knew me. Our door was always wide open. You know, our neighbors and passersby would always jump in to come say hello. It was this world that just gave me so much attention and love. I lived there until I was 9 years old, which is when I moved to the U.S. There's a lot of political turmoil in Ethiopia, and when we moved and all of us were sort of together here, I thought, are we visiting? Are we staying? What's going on? Kind of thing. And my dad looked very firm, and he's like, this is our home. There's no leaving. There's no turning back. First year was really the hardest year. My dad was working two jobs and we rarely saw him. My mom, you know, she's used to working outside of the house and she was at home. She was so much of a sort of a shell of herself, of what she was like in like taking the time to make beautiful embroidered, you know, dresses. There's just so much less levity in the house. There weren't mangoes on the porch. Our apartment was right in front of the steps, and I can hear people coming up and down the steps. Part of me was like, okay, maybe somebody will stop by and say hello, introduce themselves, ask me who I am, you know? And no one ever stopped by. I just felt sort of reduced and sort of on the sidelines of maybe someone else's world. I didn't have the tools language-wise, but even sort of culturally to understand what was going on here. One of the things that was difficult was race. When I was living in Ethiopia, all I knew was Ethiopians, and of course it was pretty familiar. So I had never had a context of myself as being Black. The first time that I remember being in a store and being followed by the store owner and then being confused about why that might be was a difficult thing to navigate. I didn't really think about the dress for many years until I was an adult when my mom gave it to me. Right around the time that I was going into medical school, I remember her saying, you know, I have something for you. And she pulled it out. At first, I didn't know whose dress it was. And when she told me, at first I was confused. How did the dress make it here from Ethiopia to Seattle? She explained that she brought it with her across the water, across the country, and kept it with her for all of these years. It really made me quite teary because it was like, wow, this dress is sort of a physical embodiment of the ways in which I've been loved and I am loved. There are a lot of different ways in which the world has tried and continues to try to define me. And I think what the dress sort of allows me to do is to say, actually, no, I get to sort of anchor myself in all the beautiful things that made me. I could really go anywhere and I could really do anything and then still come home and be loved and be cared for.
That was Mahalat Assefa in Seattle, Washington, for our series, Throw It Back. Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. World-class runners complete a marathon in close to 2 hours. Wheelchair champions, on the other hand, finish the same course about 30 to 45 minutes faster, often exceeding 20 miles an hour on a flat stretch. With the New York City Marathon coming up in 2 weeks, we wanted to talk to one of the fastest wheelchair racers in the world, American Daniel Romanchuk. Daniel, welcome to the program. It's great to have you on.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're known for being very fast on uphills, which any bicyclist knows are a lot harder to tackle than flats and downhills. I mean, what's your secret on the hills?
So I grew up about half hour outside of Baltimore in Mount Airy, Maryland. And so as the name implies, I kind of grew up climbing hills. I always love a hilly course.
Daniel, you were born with spina bifida, which restricts your leg movements. How did you get into wheelchair racing and how old were you?
So I started wheelchair racing at 4 years old with the Bennett Blazers, physically adaptive sports program out of Baltimore, Maryland. I actually started with the program at 2 years old. So they're a multi-sport program. I was swimming at three, started wheelchair racing and wheelchair basketball at four, sled hockey, and they offered many other sports. So I got my start there. Then I moved out to Illinois to continue pursuing racing.
Daniel, you all go so darn fast. It's hard to see sort of how you move the wheels, how you steer and sit. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. And so as far as pushing the chair, we have some 3D printed gloves that we glue rubber onto. And then we have our push rim that we'll also glue rubber onto as well. And so actually we don't grab the hand ring at all because that would be slowing us down. So it's actually just friction based, just rubber on rubber. And then for the steering, similar to a bike, our front wheel determines the direction that we go. But unlike a bike, we don't have to constantly be steering because we have basically a dampener that keeps the front wheel at a default direction. So we don't have to constantly have our hands on the steering because that would make a very slow race.
Right. You'll take part in the New York Marathon, as we mentioned, November 3rd. You won the wheelchair division there in 2018 at just age 20. You were the youngest person to win. I mean, talk about that course. What's key to winning this time?
It's going to be a tough race. So we've got a lot of great athletes. And, you know, I'd say it's got a great start going up the Verrazano. I like it.
It's got those hills you're used to.
Yep. So it's going to be an interesting day.
You placed second last year in New York. I mean, what's your strategy this year to bring home the number one?
I think I'll probably go into it pretty much like I do every race. I will arrive in town a couple days, few days before the race, and I like to preview the course and just to get an eye on the road conditions, and especially with some of those hills and maybe if there's turns at the bottom, stuff like that. I really like to get a look at the road conditions to make sure I know if there's a little bit of a rough part of the road, say the right side, I know to avoid that patch coming down a hill.
Daniel Romanchuk, two-time gold medalist in the Paralympic Games and founder of the charity Wheels for Change. Daniel, thank you, and best of luck in New York.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Do you love KAXE? Do you work in a business in northern Minnesota? You can support this station by becoming a business sponsor. Find out more, email sponsors at kaxe.org or call 218-326-1234 and ask for Peggy, Jen, or Chris. Center Stage Minnesota celebrates the talents of Minnesota musicians Fridays at 2 and 10 p.m. with Malachi Coons. Find interviews with Minnesota artists like Cornbread Harris, Davina and the Vagabonds, and more. Mississippi Headwaters Audubon Society and Conservation Minnesota present a workshop on light pollution and its effects on wildlife today from 1 to 4 at the Nielsen Spearhead Center, southwest of Bemidji. The session includes building bat boxes. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition here on KAXE, KBXE.
I'm Dwali Saikautel in New York City with these headlines. Prabowo Subianto is now the eighth president of the world's most populous Muslim-majority nation, Indonesia. The controversial former general was sworn in today. In Thailand, severe flooding that began earlier this month in the north of the country is finally leveling, especially in the country's central plains. And canceling a subscription or membership in the U.S. could become a little easier now that a new federal rule has been announced called Click to Cancel. The new Federal Trade Commission framework requires companies to offer clear and simpler ways to cancel or stop recurring charges. I'm Dwali Saikautel, NPR News in New York.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Eric Westervelt, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us all the way from Beijing this week is Will Shortz, puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. Hey, Will, how's it going?
Not bad. How you doing, Eric?
I'm well, thanks. And what are you up to in China?
It's the World Puzzle Championship. Right now, as we speak, Japan is way in the lead, and the U.S. and China are fighting for second place.
Will, this whole thing is something you've helped put together?
I founded the World Puzzle Championship in New York in 1992, and it goes to a different country every year.
Well, we're about to do our own puzzle championship. So, Will, please remind us of last week's challenge.
Yes, it came from listener Mike Selinker of Renton, Washington. I said, think of something to drink whose name is a compound word. Drop the first letter of the first part and you'll get some athletes. Drop the first letter of the second part and you'll get where these athletes compete. What words are these? And the something to drink is a screwdriver. Drop the S from the front and you get crew. And drop the D and you get river. Because a crew would compete on a river.
There were more than 700 correct entries, and this week's winner is Shailesh Dubey of Battle Creek, Michigan. Congratulations, Shailesh.
Thank you.
How long have you been playing the puzzle, and do you like other kinds of puzzles as well?
Yeah, I like a lot of puzzles, and trivias are kind of my one of the passions. And I've been sending online since more than 5 years.
Okay, Shailesh, are you ready to play the puzzle?
I had my coffee, I have pen and paper, and my fingers are crossed.
All right, the coffee puzzle paradox. Okay, take it away, Will.
All right, Shailesh and Eric, I'm going to give you 2 5-letter words. Put the same pair of letters in front of each of them to complete 2 common 7-letter words. For example, if I said dress, D-R-E-S-S, and verse, V-E-R-S-E, you would put A-D in front to make address an adverse. Okay, here's number 1. Voice, V-O-I-C-E, and stall, S-T-A-L-L.
I-N, invoice and install.
You got it. Number 2 is 8, E-I-G-H-T, and agile, A-G-I-L-E.
Freight and fragile.
You got it, nice. Try this, scene, S-C-E-N-E, and serve, S-E-R-V-E.
Observe and obscene.
Excellent. Great, G-R-A-T-E, and steak, S-T-A-K-E. And the second word is something that you don't want to commit.
Migrate and mistake.
You got it, nice. Spice, S-P-I-C-E. And style, S-T-I-L-E.
Spice and style.
I'll tell you, the first word is a place you might go for help if you are ill.
Not hospice. Hospice and hostile.
You got it. How about brace, B-R-A-C-E, and irate, I-R-A-T-E?
Embrace and emirate.
Good one. Amber, A-M-B-E-R, and Alice, A-L-I-C-E.
It's not malice.
This one is two consonants.
You could drink a glass of something in it, right, Will?
That's true. The second word is something you can drink from.
Chamber and chalice.
Nice. Here's your last one. Tempt, T-E-M-P-T, and heist, H-E-I-S-T.
Oh, attempt and atheist.
Atheist, yeah, you got it.
You got it. Good job.
Yeah, nice job, Shailish. How do you feel?
Relieved, as they say. It was a lot of fun.
Well, you did great. And for playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin, the famous lapel pin, as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. Shailish, what member station do you listen to?
Michigan Public.
That's Shailish Dubey of Battle Creek, Michigan. Thank you for playing the puzzle.
Thank you, Eric, and thank you, Will.
All right, Will, what is next week's challenge for everybody?
Yes, it comes from listener David Dickerson of Tucson, Arizona. The city Utica, New York, when spelled out, contains 12 letters, all of them different. Think of a well-known U.S. city that, when its name is spelled out, contains 13 letters, all of them different. And your answer doesn't have to match mine. So again, name a U.S. city, 13 letters when spelled out, and all those letters are different. Can you think of one?
Utica. When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, and click on Submit Your Answer link. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, October 24th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Please don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. And if you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, we're not telemarketers or pollsters, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and the puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shorts. Will, thank you. Have fun in China.
Thanks a lot, Eric.
Who knew there's such a creature known as the Western spotted skunk? Yes, a spotted skunk. Turns out we don't know much about this small, oddly cute creature. They weigh 1 to 2 pounds and are about the size of a squirrel. Researchers liken it to a black and white tube sock, and it's elusive, at least compared to its more urban cousin, the striped skunk. That's in part because the spotted skunk is nocturnal, with a habitat reaching from British Columbia to New Mexico and from Colorado west to California. And yeah, they stink, with even more pungence than striped skunks, by many accounts. Think really strong raw garlic. But there's been little research on the spotted skunk, that is, until now. Thanks to some intrepid researchers from Oregon State University and the U.S. Forest Service, we're learning more about this creature whose population could soon be in peril. Using cans of sardines and cat food, the researchers baited the skunks. Once caught, they tagged the animals with radio collars and tracked their lives for 2 years using more than 100 cameras set up across the Cascade Mountains. The goal? Gather data about how the animals adapt to their changing habitat. Small carnivores like skunks are especially vulnerable to environmental changes often caused by human activity. The researchers published their findings in the journal Ecosphere and hope this new data can help stave off population declines like those suffered by the eastern spotted skunk decades ago. Sean Baker always wanted to make a movie set in the Brooklyn neighborhoods of Brighton Beach and Coney Island. He and a collaborator were drawn to stories of Russian Americans living there.
It just took us about 15 to almost 20 years to figure out what the plot would be. But now we're here.
Here is an understatement. Try rave reviews and a prestigious Palme d'Or for Sean Baker at this year's Cannes Film Festival. The plot of his new movie, Anora, follows a young woman who gives lap dances at a Manhattan strip club. One night, her boss asks Anora, or Annie as she goes by, to take care of a new client, a young, wealthy Russian.
And ты должна знать русский, правильно?
I can speak Russian. I just prefer not to. But you can go ahead and speak Russian. Uh-huh. I'll understand.
I not understand. What the f***?
Okay. Привет, Иван. Меня зовут Ани. Это как я говорю по-русски.
With that awkward first encounter, a relationship of sorts begins, one that could give Annie's life a makeover. But writer-director Sean Baker doesn't traffic in fairy tales. Just take another of his acclaimed dramas, The Florida Project, about children growing up poor in a hotel in the shadow of Disney World. Like that movie, Anora is gritty and enchanting, and the title character is something of a mystery, which is what Baker wanted.
You know, I don't really ever flesh out my backstories just because my stories usually take place in the present, and I just want the audience to be in the present moment. I do, of course, have a little bit of detail that comes through. You'd understand that she is first generation. She is ethnic Russian, so she's from one of the post-Soviet countries. Her mother came over when she was a teenager or even younger, and Annie seems to be the breadwinner.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the relationship between Annie and Ivan, or Vanya, this son of a wealthy Russian. I mean, they seem to switch between having a very transactional relationship, all business, and then having something else. Is there a genuine connection between Annie and Ivan?
I believe so. I mean, Ivan is 21 years old. Annie is 23. They're both young people. And I think that for her, she finds him to be a charming, fun individual who has a life that she desires. And I think Mikey Madison, who plays Annie in the film, we had a lot of discussion about where she is in her life and whether or not she truly is in love with Ivan when they get married in a very impromptu way in Vegas. And we both came to the conclusion that she may not be in love at the moment, but she sees the potential.
Mm. I read a quote from your wife, Samantha Kwan, also a producer of this movie, and she said, "You have always been interested in people and situations that are always there, but people choose not to see them." What does that quote mean in the context of Anora and of your body of work?
I have to ask her what that meant. I don't know. I think she's referring to the subject matter of my films, that perhaps this is subject matter that is not covered as much as other subject matter in U.S. film and TV.
And those are the lives of sex workers and people on the margins in some respects?
I guess so. I've made now 8 features, and 7 of the 8 focus on, you could say, marginalized subcultures or communities. I like to see it as people who are chasing the American dream, but don't have easy access to it. They're perhaps an undocumented immigrant, or perhaps they have a livelihood or a lifestyle that has unfair stigma applied to it. And so they have to find other ways of actually pursuing the American dream.
Sean, you've had something of an unconventional path in Hollywood, and you've made it defying expectations of that town. I mean, what got you into making movies in the first place?
Well, I've been in love with the movies since 5 years old, when my mother introduced them to me by going to the local library and somewhere in Central Jersey. And they were showing clips from the Universal monster films from the 30s. So basically, Dracula rising from the grave, the mummy getting stabbed with that spear, and then the burning windmill sequence at the end of James Whale's 1931 version of Frankenstein, and that hit me. The next morning, I told my mother I want to make movies. Then Star Wars came out the next year, and from that point on, I was that cliche of the kid making Super 8 movies, moving on to VHS films, eventually going to film school, graduating, and trying to make my first feature.
Wow, from age 5 or 6, you knew.
Yeah. Now, my focus very much changed. I wasn't exposed to much world cinema, so I was exposed to, of course, Hollywood blockbusters and mainstream films. And I went to NYU thinking I was going to be making the next Die Hard or RoboCop someday. And I think it was my 4 years here in Manhattan that kind of changed my focus.
Well, we're glad you didn't make Die Hard 20 or whatever number we're on. Maybe someday.
Yeah.
Just for the record. You have such an affection, even a reverence, for many of the places you depict, no matter how sort of shabby, grubby, and plain they can appear on the surface. You manage to find the beauty in them.
Well, I see beauty everywhere, and so do my wonderful DPs, my director of photography. There is a long tradition of social realist films that I'm very influenced by the way. And there was a time where I believe they started to become a little bleak. And even the look, even the style of the films were very gray. And I think to depict what they thought were the inner lives of people going through a lot of hardship. And I always thought that was unfair, because I know if I had somebody make a film about my life, I wouldn't want it to look just gray and drab. Even when I'm going through hard times, I still see color, I still see beauty. And I think that we tried to reflect that in the style of the film. We find the color out there. We find ways of framing landscapes that I think allow us to really appreciate that there's beauty everywhere.
Were there times when you were going through your own hard times where you can point to and say, but I still saw the beauty around me?
I've been through some crazy times, mostly self-imposed. You know, I was in active, active addiction in my 20s on opiates, and yet there was still the hope that I would pull out of it. And that was the drive to actually make films was one of the primary reasons that I worked to get clean.
I don't want to give away any spoilers here, but the end of Anora is powerful, and it's really, as affecting as anything I've seen on screen in recent memory. Is it possible for you to touch on what were you striving for there?
Oh, well, thank you. It was a very important scene for me. For me, endings are the most important part of the cinema-going experience, because it's what you're leaving the audience with and what they'll be talking about moments later on the sidewalk. For this moment, I think it's a moment of intimacy that we haven't seen earlier in the film. There's a catharsis there. It's been very interesting to hear the interpretations of the last scene. That's how it's designed, because it's really not leaving you with any solid answer of what's about to come in Annie's life. It's really up to the audience at that point to sort of write the ending. And it's been really incredible to see that that's what's been happening.
That's Sean Baker, writer and director of the new movie, Anora. It's in select cities now. Sean, it was a real pleasure speaking with you.
You too. Thank you so much for having me on.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Aisha Roscoe is back next week. I'm Eric Westervelt. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Bemidji Symphony Orchestra, a community orchestra servicing north central Minnesota, bringing classical music to audiences and providing performance experience for musicians. More at BemidjiSymphony.org. Adventures in Lifelong Learning meets every Tuesday morning at the Bemidji Eagles Club, now through November 12th. Refreshments served at 9:30, with various speakers at 10 a.m. each meeting. And you can continually support Northern Community Radio by becoming a sustaining member. Choose a monthly payment amount and a payment method, and you can sit back and enjoy KAXE, KBXE programming, knowing that you are helping to make it all possible. Become a sustaining member at KAXE.org or text DONATE to 218 326-1234. Early voting is now open for the November 5th general election throughout the state of Minnesota. Find more information at